If you want to grow a stunning garden, you need to be both an artist and a scientist. The best gardens are composed like any other piece of art. You choose the materials, then you mix them together carefully to create something that has purpose and meets aesthetic goals that you've set. You might be creating a sense of formality or informality, or trying to create a feeling of relaxation, calmness, or a feeling of a lot of energy and active movement. When people paint a painting of something, they're thinking about the feelings and the aesthetics and the moods that they're trying to create in the painting. Think about a garden the same way. You're taking hard landscape materials, your soil, your gravel, concrete, timber, brick, stone, whatever. These are non-living components, and you're putting them together to create that mood or feeling or aesthetic that you're trying to get. And then you're taking plants, living materials, and you're selecting what plants you want, and you're arranging them the same way. Now, gardeners, when they're designing gardens, should be thinking about things like balance and contrast and tone and mood and colour. If you've got a garden that's got all cool colours like blues and whites, you're going to create a feeling of calmness and coolness. But if you've got a garden that's got a lot of bright colours like, say, reds and oranges and yellows, you're going to create a more active sort of mood. Doesn't mean you have exclusively just whites in a garden or exclusively yellows or just one colour. You're always going to have greens and or maybe various shades of greens because that's what the foliage often is, and you might have different colors in barks too. But when it comes to flowers, don't restrict yourself to necessarily just the one thing. But if there's a dominance of one thing, that's going to influence your mood. And if it's a dominance of calmer, cooler colors, that will influence the mood to a calmer, cooler sort of feeling in the garden. If it's a dominance of those more bright colors, it's going to influence the mood there. Then the other factor, of course, is how much light gets into the garden. If you've got a lot of trees or you've built pergolas and buildings that create shade and you haven't got so much light, even the bright colors are not going to pop as much as what they would if it's more open and you're getting a lot more light into the garden. Depends on the climate you're in too. But what about the science side? The thing is, you can't really create a garden unless you understand the science as well. If you take those non-living landscape materials and you use the wrong materials, they're just not going to be resilient. They're not going to stay there and not change over time. Use the wrong wood and it rots away and you've lost it. If you use the right wood, it may last for 10, 20, even 100 or 200 years, depending on how you treat it, what wood you use, where you get it from. Same with stones. Some stone will wear down in rain and weathering, rain and wind. That can cause the stone, like sandstones, to gradually weather. Other stones, not so much. They might stay the same and last for hundreds, even thousands of years. Some stones are going to change colour over time with weathering. Other stone doesn't. You've got to think about all those sorts of things and understand how stone might change, or wood might change, or gravel might change, or concrete might change over time. Metal, any hard non-living materials you're using. So there's a science involved there. Then, what about the plants? Now that's where it gets very complicated because there are 100,000 or more, maybe even 150,000 different plants which are commonly used in gardens. And there's no way anyone's going to learn and know all of those plants inside out. It's a lot easier for an artist who's creating paintings. They just need to learn about watercolor or oil color or a few other types of paint materials and how those vary and understand a little bit of science behind that. They only need to learn about different colors and a little bit of that. But a garden designer or a gardener needs to understand all of those different plants, and there's thousands of times more plants and more variation in plants than what you will get in the variation in paints. The thing about it is, though, there's always something new to learn, and learning about plants it can be addictive. I started over 50 years ago when I studied horticulture, and I'm still tripping across plants and going, oh wow, I've never seen that color in that plant before. I've never seen one of those that grows so small or grows so big. I need to just keep learning more and more about those plants. But the other factor with plants is that different plants grow in different ways in different situations. So you can take the same plant and put it in one climate and it will grow smaller than what it will in another climate. You can put it in one soil and it will grow smaller than what it will in another soil. It might grow bushier in one situation than another, depending on the light conditions, the soil conditions, the rainfall, the moisture in the soil, the drainage, the fertility of the soil. It goes on and on. All of these factors affect how plants grow. So knowing your plants and knowing what they can do in the environment where you're creating a garden is very important. Now, luckily, nature has a system to it. The natural world has evolved over time. And if we look at trying to get to know the science behind plants, plants are named scientifically according to how closely related they are to each other. If particular plants have grown and evolved in a particular place over millennia, and then split off, and variations have started to develop, and then we've got new species and new genera of those plants. Those genera and those species that all came from the same parent maybe 3 or 4 million years ago, those plants will have similar characteristics. They'll have similar characteristics in terms of how they look, and they will have similar characteristics in terms of where you grow them and how you treat them, what sort of fertility or soil conditions or water conditions or whatever. Well, the probability is that there are always odd variations and exceptions to rules, but if you can get to know plant families and you understand that, say, example, the Asteraceae family, that's a family of plants which have daisy flowers. Now, that family, most of them like a reasonable level of air in the soil. They need, and you get that by having fairly good drainage in the soil. Some of them can tolerate fairly dry conditions, but most of them are only going to grow and grow reasonably well. If the soil's moist. Now, I don't mean really wet, I mean just moist. Now, if you understand some of those factors about daisy family plants, and you see a plant and you don't know it, and you're thinking, oh, I might include that in my garden, you can make an educated guess of how you might treat it, particularly if you know five or six or seven other daisy plants. And you've grown those, and you've got the experience of growing those. The other characteristic that's interesting is plants in the same family also have similar susceptibilities to diseases and pests. So, if you find a plant that, say, is attacked by mealybug, And you know what plant family it's in, and then you find another plant in the same family. That other plant in the same family is likely to be susceptible to mealybug too. Now, one of the things about designing a garden from a science point of view and getting it to always look good is to keep the plants healthy all the time. And if you want to keep them healthy, you don't want pests and diseases getting in there and attacking the plants and just making them look really, really bad. Now, one of the best ways to achieve that is through biodiversity. Don't plant hundreds and hundreds of the same plant altogether. You have a variety of different plants all mixed up. If you've got a plant from one plant family that's susceptible to mealybug growing next to a plant from a totally different family that is not susceptible to mealybug, then the mealybug, if it gets onto one of the plants, it's not going to spread to the other. And if a disease gets on the other plant, which is not mealybug, which it is susceptible to, it might not spread to the over to the plant that's susceptible to mealybug. In other words, if you've got a lot of different types of plants, then you're not going to get a disease come in like a plague and kill everything. That's why we have plagues like COVID with people. Humans are everywhere, and you get one disease that affects one human and we're all crowded into a city together and it'll spread through us all. But imagine if every person in the city was susceptible to different things, but not all susceptible to COVID. COVID wouldn't have spread the same way. You also find there are all sorts of other factors involved in the science of plants. Now, I was just talking to someone yesterday and explaining we were talking about using sugarcane mulch as a mulch on gardens. And I used to do that, but then I found the sugarcane mulch would attract ants. So I sort of slowed down on using sugarcane mulch because I didn't want ants biting me when I was out in the garden. And then this person said to me, oh, I heard that one of the problems with putting sugar in the garden is that it can make it harder for plants to absorb water. And the thing about that is, the way, if you understand the science, the way plants absorb water is through a process called osmosis. And what osmosis is that there's a barrier between the root, the cells on the outside of the root, and the soil outside of it. And in the soil, you've got the water, and in the root, you've got the sap of the plant, and that sap travels up into the plant and carries nutrients up. Now, osmosis is all about evening out concentrations. If you've got a barrier and you've got a low concentration of something in water on one side and a high concentration of something in water on the other side, there will be a natural tendency. This is basic physics and chemistry. There's a natural tendency for that to even out. So the high concentration chemical will move through to the low, the side where the low concentration is, so you've got the same concentration on both. Now, get back to the root. If you've got a root and you've got a plant cell and you've got soil on one side and you've got chemical inside the cell, and the chemical inside the cell has a high concentration of sugar, and the chemical out and the water outside the cell doesn't have a high concentration of sugar, it just has low concentration water, well, the water outside will tend to move into the cell to lower the concentration of sugar inside the cell in order to even up that concentration. That's how osmosis works. Now, as the water moves into the cell that has a little bit of sugar in the water inside the cell, then that can get into the sap and then it can go up into the plant and it can provide water for the plant. If we put sugar, sugarcane mulch or sugar in any other way in the soil, and you've got a high concentration of sugar outside the cell and a medium concentration inside the cell, it's going to force the water to go from inside the cell to outside the cell to even out that concentration. And evening out the concentration like that is actually going to dehydrate the plant. It's going to take water out of the plant. Now, this might all sound a bit like gobbledygook, rubbish to some people. It might be a bit too complex, but the point I'm trying to make here is that those complexities of science do have a relevance in the way you grow a garden. When I grow a garden, I'm looking at it, putting everything together from an artistic point of view, but I'm also thinking about the science, and knowing about the science, having learnt chemistry, having learnt botany, having learnt about soil science and environmental science and all those sorts of things when I first studied horticulture, that's allowed me to not only look at a plant and think, oh, that would look lovely there, but also think, okay, is it going to grow well there? Are the conditions right? Is the environment right? And what do I need to do to change the soil or change the environment or do whatever to make that plant look the way it potentially could look? And if I can't easily do those things, maybe I need to look at an alternative plant. And that's where it comes into the whole thing of knowing more plants comes in. If you're a person who knows 10 plants and you're trying to design gardens, you've only got 10 choices to, or 10 things to choose from. But if you know 5,000 plants, and I know about that number of plants, then you've got a lot more things to choose from. And if you look at the garden and the science, your knowledge of science is telling you this won't work in this place, then you've got a lot of other options you can choose. If you don't learn your plants, you don't have those other options. If you don't learn your science, you really can't make the best decisions about where to put things. And if you don't know the art, even if you know your science inside out and you're a good gardener from that point of view, you might be able to grow plants, you might be able to choose plants, but you're not going to make something which is aesthetically pleasing, which is meeting the functional requirements and the aesthetic requirements to make that garden really something special and really attractive and meet the needs of yourself or the client or your employer where you're working in that garden.